This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates says he's ready to increase the size of the U.S. Army.
I am announcing a decision to temporarily increase the active duty in strength of the Army by up to 22,000. That is a temporary increase from the current authorized and permanent in strength of 547,000 to an authorized temporary in strength of 569,000 active duty soldiers.
Some of these troops might end up in Afghanistan. Is it enough? That's coming up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, July 21st. I'm Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scher. We're filling in for John Hockenberry. Morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Farai.
On the show today, we will simplify the healthcare debate, find out what possible changes will mean for your health and your bank account. And speaking of banks, we know the big ones are making buckets of money. But it might be a different story for some smaller banks in our communities. We will talk to one of them to see how the little guys are doing. Also, more peril in Afghanistan. Let's start with a deeper look with Jill McGivering, BBC correspondent specializing in Asia. She is with us from London. There is a lot of news coming out of Afghanistan. Jill, you've been monitoring it. What's happening?
I'm afraid it's been bloody. A series of casualties, roadside bombs, and just recently today, attacks on government buildings in the east of the country. It's all evidence of this violence worsening in the country as Afghanistan heads toward elections next month.
Well, we've got more of that conversation in a moment. First, we've got everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, President Obama steps up his push for major health care change. He's going to meet with key House Democrats to push for his plan. He'll also give a speech on the health care agenda. And California has a deal to close its enormous budget gap. $26 billion shortfall it was facing. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and lawmakers now have a plan. Billions in programs will be cut. They will shift some money around. A vote on the proposed plan could come Thursday.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testifies on the Hill in Washington later this morning to give lawmakers there and investors watching his latest take on the economy. Our partner, the New York Times, reports a government agency covered up research on the dangers of driving while using mobile phones. A former federal safety chief says transit officials told him to bury the 2003 findings because the data could anger Congress and threaten Transportation Department funding.
And Japan is bracing for elections. The White House goes country tonight. It's hosting country music artists. NASA says Jupiter has taken a hit. And in the markets, Wall Street gained more than 1% yesterday. The Dow starts trading at 8848, S&P at 951, an eight-month high. NASDAQ kicks off at 1909. Washington is working furiously in the healthcare debate. Question is how to pay for it and what is covered. Patrick in Detroit emails us, my deal breaker is less than all Americans being covered. I'm mad at Swift Boat, Willie Horton-like ads trying to scare people about Canadian-style insurance. So what do you think should not be covered? What do you think needs to be put on the table for health care? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scher, here with Farai Chidea, and we're in for John Hockenberry. Escalation in Afghanistan. Today, there have been Taliban attacks on two eastern cities in Afghanistan. The main one was in the city of Gardez. Taliban militants dressed as women and wearing burqas tried to set off explosives but were shot before they could do so. There's been considerable bloodshed. The Associated Press reporting that a total of 13 Taliban militants and Afghan security forces have died in the attacks in both cities. To get a sense of how our partners, the BBC, are reporting the story this morning, we go to BBC reporter and a good friend of The Takeaway, Jill McGivering in London. Jill, what is going on right now?
It seems as though these were male suicide bombers, but dressed as women in those all-encompassing burqas, which is a tactic that has been used before, partly, of course, because they are so voluminous and they cover any kind of suicide vest quite effectively, but also partly because of the cultural sensitivities. It is difficult for male guards, for example, to approach women who are wearing the burqa. To search them, of course, is very difficult. It requires women being available to do that, and often they're not available. So it's one of those things that is quite easy to do, very difficult to guard against, as with suicide bombing itself.
And it looks as if they were coordinated attacks, is that correct?
That certainly seems to be the case, yes. It seems to have been a series of coordinated blasts. Again, it seems to be just with this surge in violence we've been seeing quite recently, there have been quite a few hallmarks of the kind of violence, the kind of patterns we used to see quite often in Iraq a few years ago. And I think those kind of coordinated attacks increasingly happening now in Afghanistan is another indication of that.
Well, obviously also coming off of the death of the four American troops, the deaths of the four American troops on Monday. This, we keep saying this has been a brutal month, this has been a bloody month for Afghanistan, but is it indeed an escalation or is it business as usual?
I think there's no doubt that the level of casualties we are seeing is greater than we've seen pretty much since 2001, and it's causing enormous concern. It's causing, of course, political and humanitarian concern back home for the countries that are involved in sending most of the troops there. And, of course, it's very destabilizing for Afghanistan itself. I was in Helmand just 6 months ago meeting ordinary folk there and trying to get a sense from them about some of the positives in terms of development and so on. There is a lot of development work being done, a lot of money being poured into Afghanistan. But everybody I was meeting was saying, you know, never mind about the schools and the clinics and things. We haven't got security yet. Until we have security, you guys aren't safe, but we're not safe either. We can't live our lives normally. And I think that's part of the whole destabilization that's going on in the run-up to the elections.
And what are the strains on the coalition at this point? Is there a danger of it falling apart?
I think there's certainly concern. We're hearing comments from the Secretary General of NATO at the moment, who's in London, talking about the fact that NATO cannot afford to walk away from Afghanistan at this time, saying, look, the cost would be too great, particularly in terms of possible attacks in the West. But there are clearly tensions within NATO. There are some countries saying, look, we, like the United States and the second biggest contingent, Britain as well, we are contributing a lot of the people and we are seeing a lot of the casualties, not the only ones, but we're bearing a lot of this burden. And I think that's part of the whole debate going on at the moment about some countries which are part of NATO, which may indeed have a presence there. 42 countries have soldiers in Afghanistan, but they may be doing some of the less dangerous stuff, like getting involved in training, perhaps, but they have definite caveats, definite limits on what they will and won't do. And that's causing some resentment, clearly.
Jill McGivering with the BBC in London for that update on Afghanistan. We thank you very much. And continuing with our look at the war in Afghanistan, we're going to focus now on the prisons there, specifically the U.S.-run Bagram prison. Its reputation is daunting. Reports of abuse have been well documented. Just for example, two Afghan detainees died there in 2002 after being beaten by American soldiers and hung by their arms from the ceiling of isolation cells. Now, the U.S. military review calls for an overhaul of Bagram to separate extremist prisoners from the general population, to start training programs for life beyond bars. One major motivation? Concern that abuses and militancy inside its walls are helping strengthen the Taliban. So is this move good for detainees, or is it just good public relations? To help answer that question, we turn to Jonathan Hafitz. He's an attorney in the National Security Project at the ACLU, who's represented detainees from Iraq and Bagram and Guantanamo. And he joins us here in our studio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
The Pentagon has commissioned this report to be released later today to review all of the detention issues in Afghanistan. Is this, in fact, good news for the detainees?
Well, it could be. Certainly the fact that the Defense Department is taking a hard look at detention operations could be a positive sign, but the devil will be in the details in terms of the recommendations it makes and the steps it takes to reform U.S. detention operations.
Start with this very simplest one, or one simplest for us to understand, the idea of separating out the extremists in the prison from the general population, for perhaps people arrested for different crimes, not terrorism, or less extreme forms of terrorism, and then training. Isn't this seems reasonably understandable.
Yeah, I mean, these sound like positive steps, separating prisoners out and providing training to different prisoners. But what I've not seen mentioned, and one thing we're really going to be looking for, is any reforms in terms of the process that's afforded detainees to determine whether or not we're holding the right people. A district judge has ruled in a case this spring that the process that's used at Bagram is inadequate. It's worse even than the process that was used at Guantanamo, which the Supreme Court ruled was unconstitutional. So I don't think we really have any confidence that we're holding the right people at Bagram.
Jonathan Hafitz from the ACLU is talking about this prison situation at Bagram. What about Americans concerned about terrorism? What about Americans who are saying, oh, if you release all those prisoners, they may join the Taliban, they may join Al-Qaeda, whatever?
Well, I think it's important to understand, and we've seen this in Iraq, that arbitrary detention, sweeps of people, including people from their home, which constitutes a lot of the people at Bagram, does not help American security, but harms it. It breeds a lot of unhappiness and anger in the population if people are being taken away, locked up, often for many years without a fair hearing, and this undermines American security and stability. So a sound, rights-respecting detention process where people are given a fair hearing and not held for years without charge will help American troops do their job.
Jonathan, it's Farai here. What about the politics of this? Some people who voted for Barack Obama back when he was a senator and candidate thought that he would come in and completely change the detention policies. What are you seeing from the White House?
Well, we're seeing, unfortunately, a lot more continuity than change. For example, the United States has continued to defend not just holding people at Bagram, but capturing people from anywhere in the world, places as far as Thailand or the Middle East, and bringing them to Bagram and holding them without judicial review. We've also seen the administration appearing to endorse a system of indefinite, prolonged, potentially lifelong detention without charge, including for detainees at Guantanamo.
Jonathan Hafitz from the ACLU. This review is not only of Bagram, but it's of the entire prison system in Afghanistan. Is this realistic in a country where their sense of a judicial system is very different from ours? Can we make it happen? Can they make it happen?
Well, I mean, I think it's important for both countries to be involved. The U.S. is obviously actively involved in Afghanistan, including in holding prisoners. But it's a good point. The Afghan system also needs to be fair, and it's important that the United States build and help reconstruct a valid and legal system to function in Afghanistan.
How bad is Bagram? Is it Abu Ghraib all over again? Is it Guantanamo? How should we understand this?
Well, Bagram has largely been under the radar, so the fact there hasn't been a lot of attention paid to it in many ways helps us understand why conditions there have been so bad. Some of the worst abuses in the entire so-called war on terror have been carried out at Bagram, physical abuses that's led to the death and injury of many prisoners. So Bagram is a very bad place, and the fact that there's so much secrecy around it has only hurt and not helped bring reforms.
Remind us, 600 prisoners, is that correct, in Bagram?
Approximately 600 as far as we know. And we filed a Freedom of Information Act request to try to find out information about the prisoners, their treatment, and the opportunity they're being given to challenge their detention. And regrettably, the Defense Department has denied our request, saying it's not a sufficiently important public matter, which is going to force us to bring litigation to get the information to the American people and to the world about what's actually happening inside of Bagram.
And that report is expected, is it later today or tomorrow? Later today, right?
The government's report, but we're seeking, a broad range of information about Bagram to provide to the American public.
But we will be looking at that report when it comes out to see what the specifics are. Jonathan Hafitz, attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project, thanks so much for helping us.
A lot of news from the region of Afghanistan. We're also going to be getting to more of that later today. Also coming up, the global growth of a new type of drug. What makes it so dangerous? Well, we're talking about fake medications.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea, in with Lynn Scher. John Hockenberry is away. We're going to talk about a young man. His hair, his smile, and of course his rounded glasses haven't changed very much, but the boy has grown to a teen. I'm talking about Harry Potter in the first movie, based, of course, on the best-selling books. He was just a young boy with no clue how to be a wizard.
First year students will require 3 sets of plain work robes, 1 wand.
Essential bit of equipment, Harry.
1 pair of dragonhide gloves. Hagrid, do they mean from a real dragon?
Well, they don't mean a penguin, do they?
6 films into the franchise, Harry Potter knows how to work his wand, and along with casting spells and chasing down the evildoer Voldemort, Harry Potter knows how to make a buck. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince premiered last Wednesday. By Sunday, the film had raked in $160 million. That's $20 million more than the previous Potter film. Today, we want to talk about Harry Potter marketing and business. With us from Novi, Michigan, is Ben Maynard. He's 17 and a diehard Harry Potter fan. Ben, just really quickly, what do you relate to in these stories?
I relate to Harry as his life and as a teenager. His world is full of magic. I kind of wish I could escape to that and flick my wand to solve all my problems.
So do I. Okay, so I understand that you have gone to the movies. You've collected some Harry Potter swag. What's the favorite thing that you've bought?
I actually kind of like the video games. It was also great to have all the DVDs on video, watch them and see all the things you missed in the theaters.
How much do you think you've spent in your lifetime?
I estimated that I've spent just over $600 on everything.
Not insignificant. Okay, we're going to get back to you in a second, but we've also got Susan Ganelius, a marketing expert and author of Harry Potter, The Story of a Global Business Phenomenon. Now, Susan, there's one thing that we can be completely sure of. Harry Potter is continuing to rake in money. What's the secret to this franchise?
The secret of that is actually consumers. Harry Potter was turned into a global phenomenon at the hands of consumers who talked about the brand that they loved and spread the word through word-of-mouth marketing and the social web.
Now, there's an emotional connection Ben talked about, but when you think about the marketing, is there one thing that stands out to you that, say, some other, you know, franchises of young adult books into movies haven't done?
Well, Harry Potter, the marketing started by the publisher following the traditional publisher model. It really wasn't until around 2000 when there was a gap of about 3 years between the first movie and the fourth book and the release of the fifth book that the online buzz and the word-of-mouth marketing really just went out of control, to be perfectly honest. And that's when the marketing team sort of realized, hey, wait a minute, we've got gold here, and started leveraging tease and perpetual marketing with the watch the space hooks, slowly releasing little bits and pieces of information, and constantly teasing people and keeping that conversation going.
Hi, Susan. It's Lynn Scher here. I have to ask a question. I think the Harry Potter phenomenon is extraordinary. I love the films. But is it possible to have good literature for children and not have a marketing phenomenon? Does it always have to go along with big money, do you think?
Absolutely not. In fact, most of the time it does not. And if you look at the Harry Potter brand, it, truth be told, has been marketed far less than most other brands. For example, at the height of the buzz about Harry Potter in the early 2000s, the brand was merchandised far less than many other brands, Cars, Shrek, a number of other Disney brands were merchandised far more. But the secret to Harry Potter's success was the fact that people were talking about it. It seemed like it was everywhere. It seemed like the marketing was being pushed at us using push marketing strategies. But in reality, it was pull marketing, consumers demanding more from the brand, constantly talking about it.
And the other thing that it struck me so much, actually, is that, in fact, kids are reading these books. They're not just seeing the movies, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's another thing that makes this brand so unique and so powerful is that it became a relationship brand. It started certainly as a cult brand, small groups banding around it, becoming emotionally involved. Emotional involvement drives brand loyalty. And then as that loyalty got stronger and stronger as people constantly were, their expectations for the brand were met. They felt comfortable, secure in the brand. It grew and grew into a relationship brand where people were surrounded by brand experiences. They could self-select how they wanted to experience the brand, share it, and build a relationship with it. Brands like Apple, these are just hugely powerful relationship brands, and that's what Harry Potter became.
All right. Want to go back to Ben Maynard. You've spent hundreds of dollars on Harry Potter merchandise. And we had on, a little bit of conversation with an 11-year-old girl who went to see it at the movie at 12:01. And she talked about how her friends spread the word. Do you use any kind of social networking like Twitter or just word of mouth to talk about Harry Potter?
Well, there are groups on Facebook that I'm on. There are also special websites devoted especially to Harry Potter. There's the official website. There's websites like MuggleNet, where you can communicate with other Harry Potter fans. Yeah.
Yes, Muggles being mere humans who can't cast magic, right?
That's right. We're all Muggles.
Well, you know, Ben, you seem like you have some superpowers, at least in choosing what you want in life. Hey, you're going to the University of Michigan next fall, and I want to thank you both. Again, Ben Maynard, 17 years old, lifelong Harry Potter fan, and Susan Ganelius, president and CEO of Key Splash Creative, author of Harry Potter, the story of a global business phenomenon. Now we go to Femi Okay with the headlines.
Thank you very much. News for Muggles this morning, 28 minutes past the hour. A new report from our partner, The New York Times, finds that researchers at a federal agency hid new information on the dangers of driving while using cell phones. A former head of the agency says that transit officials told him to shelve the research in order to avoid antagonizing Congress. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke will appear before Congress today to deliver his semi-annual update on the economy. It's the first of 2 days of testimony. His remarks come at a good moment for the U.S. stock market. The S&P 500 closed at an eight-month high yesterday of 951. Asian markets were more of a mixed bag today, though, and most European indices are up at the moment. In international news, Pakistan's military says more than 50 militants are dead after 2 days of tough fighting in the country's volatile northwest region. Several soldiers were also killed. In entertainment news, singer Chris Brown has publicly apologized for attacking his former girlfriend, pop star Rihanna. In a video on his official website, he says his actions were unacceptable.
I'm not going to sit here and make any excuses. I take great pride in me being able to exercise self-control, and what I did was inexcusable. I am very sad and very ashamed of what I've done.
Brown pleaded guilty to assault for the attack. And that's a look at news headlines for now.
Thank you so much, Femi. And coming up next, we're going to take a look at President Obama wrangling with Congress on health care.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Lynn Scherr, sitting in for John Hockenberry with Farai Chidea. We're talking right now about health care. And in the healthcare debate, if you're following the play-by-play, the day-by-day, right now it is all about deciphering the numbers. How much will it cost the federal government? And how much will it cost us? Will we have to pay more or less under the plan? And by the way, what plan? Joining us is David Herzenhorn, congressional reporter for The New York Times. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Lynn. How are you?
I'm great. Probably greater than the people debating this bill. Start with the number. We're on numbers now, right? It's all about numbers at this particular moment in the process?
It's very much about numbers. Congressional Budget Office on Friday said the House version of this bill is going to cost about $1.042 trillion over 10 years. And the really problematic number is $544 billion for members of Congress. That's the amount of money that would be raised in an income surtax on high earners. And folks are very uncomfortable with that. In fact, the Senate is not interested in it at all. And so what you have on the House side is a bunch of members of Congress wondering that if they're going to be forced to vote in favor of that and then not have it show up in the final bill, which could leave them needing political CPR at election time when opponents run ads, you know, saying you voted for
too much money, too much money.
Right.
Right. So let me ask you this, David Herzenhorn from The New York Times. Are these real numbers, the trillion-dollar number, the 500-and-some-billion-dollar number, do they really know how much it's going to cost?
They don't. These are the best projections that you can get from the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan, independent scorekeeper for Congress. And they, you know, look at all the data and, you know, everything that's been proposed in any given piece of legislation. They keep track of the federal budget as it's ongoing, and they say, here's what we think based on everything we know and what our projections are for how the economy will operate. Here's what we think this is going to cost.
Right.
So while they're not, you know, guaranteed real numbers that this is the way it's going to be, this is the only way that the government can actually function and do its budgeting. So you sort of got to go with something.
In terms of the day-to-day, President Obama has invited a small group of House Democrats, the so-called blue dogs. These are fiscally conscious House Democrats. He's invited them to the White House today to try to win over their support. What does he need to say to them to win them over?
Or what do they need to say to him to win him over? It's, you know, this is a two-way street. I mean, the real challenge here, it seems, for Congress and for President Obama is they want to do something that's really, really hard and really, really expensive, and that is cover, you know, provide health insurance to all Americans and really improve the health system while also making things cheaper. Those things often seem contradictory. And one of the challenges here is that everybody likes the goal. Nobody wants to make the tough decisions needed to get there. And so the president keeps calling in group after group, the American Medical Association of doctors, the hospitals, the nurses, trying to work out a deal. Now, every one of these compromises serves to weaken the bill to some degree by pulling it in one direction or another. So at some point, folks have got to be told no. And now for the taxpayers, they might not want the fiscally conservative blue dogs, the ones who want a balanced budget, to be the ones who the president finally gets tough with and says, no, you can't have what you're asking for.
So this is all going to at least start today at the White House. Just finally, one quick question. The president has said he'd like to see some movement on this bill before the August 7th recess. Is that a real deadline?
It's very tough. He wants it, but it's going to be very hard.
Thanks very much. Okay, David Herzenhorn, congressional reporter for The New York Times. That is healthcare today.
Well, thanks, Lynn. IOUs, I mean, you might be familiar with them. You get some money from somebody, you write them a little slip of paper. That's essentially what California has been doing because it's had a $26 billion budget deficit. But state leaders reached a deal last night to end months of political wrangling. What's in it? John Myers joins us. He's the Sacramento Bureau Chief for KQED Public Radio. He's been up all night reporting the story. John, I just want to tick off a couple of things, and you tell me how this proposed budget will impact them. First off, healthcare.
Well, it's a bit of a complicated answer. Certainly, there are going to be some major cuts for low-income people in California, children, who low-income children in California are those services are going to be cut, and some others for the seniors in California. California's a version of Medicare, which is called Medi-Cal. It's also facing about $1 billion in cuts. So tough times for those folks.
All right. What about this plan to possibly release prisoners early? $1.2 billion set to be cut from the state prison system. How realistic is that?
I think that's going to be a complicated one as well. I mean, of course, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger doesn't have to have the support or even the action of the state legislature to do that. He has the authority to do that. So the cut has been made. The question is, how do you see save that money? And there are some discussions about early release of nonviolent offenders, but that's also going to be a very complicated one and a big PR issue, too, for people who are worried about law and order issues.
What about the big picture? Is this a deal that is going to build a coalition of interest groups who fight against it, and who might some of those be, if so?
Well, you know, it's still a little early to see. I think we haven't quite seen exactly what the level of support is inside the California legislature. We certainly think that the leadership of the legislature and the governor have put together the right people, but you've got environmentalists concerned as well. That's something we haven't talked about. There's a proposal in here for some new offshore oil drilling to bring in some money. You've got also local government folks where there's a tremendous amount of borrowing from cities. Counties in California in this deal. So I do think it's going to be an interesting few days to see who, if anyone, loves it. And so far, no one does.
All right. Well, John, we are definitely going to follow up on this story. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for KQED Public Radio. And now we go to Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The Obama administration is delaying a report on detainees suspected of terrorism by at least 6 months. The president commissioned the report as part of his initiative to close the Guantanamo Bay prison camp by the beginning of next year. Now, it looks like California may have solved its $26 billion budget shortfall. Legislators reached a plan last night after more than 5 hours of closed-door talks with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrives in Thailand today, and while there, she'll meet with the Thai Prime Minister and attend the ASEAN Regional Summit later this week. Afghan officials say that 13 Taliban militants and several Afghan security forces have been killed in insurgent attacks on two cities in eastern Afghanistan. And that is a look at some of the big stories making news this morning. Farai Lin.
Thanks, Femi. I'll take it. So, we all know that pharmaceutical drugs can help save lives around the world, but not if they're fake. And the World Health Organization says 1 in 4 drugs is fake. Coming up, how to track down these fake drugs. That's in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scher.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Later this morning, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke takes the hot seat, gives lawmakers an update on the economy. He's fending off attacks from critics who blame the Fed for the economic crisis. So with the earnings by big banks in the past week, does he have better news for Congress? Joining us with a preview is Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek and Slate.com. Dan, we're hearing some people saying that the recession might be ending, big profits from Goldman Sachs last week. The Fed, what is Bernanke going to face? Populist rage, warm embrace?
I think there are going to be a couple things going on. One is the sort of basic narrative about the economy. They want to know, are we expanding again? Has the recession ended? Will we have job creation again soon? And on that, I think he has, you know, it's always a mixed picture. It's quite possible that the economy is about to start expanding again. But for most people, you know, that's just a technical difference. In other words, the unemployment rate is continuing to rise. People are expecting it to rise further. Housing is still, you know, not doing so well. So we could very well have an expansion in which people won't feel very good. So, but he does have something to say about that, which is that all these extraordinary efforts that the Fed has done starting last year have kind of stopped this precipitous decline of the economy, stabilized it to a point where we can now start arguing over whether we're going to have growth again.
All right, let me just ask, who are the critics, not necessarily of his policies, but of the range of powers he has, from
right.
TARP funds to bailouts? Are there folks that want to rein in his power?
Absolutely. And that's the second sort of component of the narrative, this sort of meta narrative, which is instead of talking about the economy, it's talking about the role of the Fed. A lot of people, left, right, center, from libertarians on the right to pro-regulation people on the left to, I think, sensible people in the center, are upset that the Federal Reserve, which is tasked with regulating a good chunk of the banking system, really fell down on the job. They didn't regulate subprime mortgages. They didn't regulate credit default swaps. They didn't see any of this disaster coming. And then, you know, told us, oh, by the way, you know, we have to do all these massive bailouts just to stop our whole economy from going down the tubes. That does not inspire a lot of confidence, especially given that the Fed's balance sheet, i.e. its intervention in the economy, has more than doubled since last fall. So they've got their hands in all these different components of the financial sector where there's been direct intervention. And there's now talk of, as we redo our regulatory structure, giving the Federal Reserve even more power than it's had before as this kind of global systemic risk.
Dan, let me interrupt. This is Lynn Scherr. And what you said leads into what I was going to ask, which is, are we approaching Greenspan mode here? Does the nation's economy rise and fall depending on what Ben Bernanke says or the way he lifts an eyebrow?
You know, I think, you know, in the 90s, there was definitely that connection where, you know, if Greenspan muttered one thing, you know, the stock market would go up 400 or 500 points. I think Bernanke doesn't have that kind of halo effect. And actually, you know, the real action these days is obviously the stock market really matters, but it's
right.
the credit markets where things really matter. And I think
okay.
you're more likely to see the credit markets, you know, what bond rates are doing, things like that, responding to individual things that he says.
All right. Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek and Slate.com. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea with Lynn Scherr in for John Hockenberry. Malaria drugs can help save lives around the world, but not if they're fake. And one in four pills is. How to track down these fake drugs, that's coming up right after headlines with Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Our partner, the New York Times, reports that a government agency covered up research on the dangers of driving while using mobile phones. A former federal safety chief says that transit officials told him to bury the 2003 findings because the data could anger Congress and threaten Transportation Department funding. Now, today is a big day for healthcare in Washington. The president will meet with key House Democrats, hoping to rally support for his agenda. Earlier, The Takeaway spoke with the Michigan Democratic Congressman Bart Stupak. Here's his take on the debate.
Instead of fixing the current system, we're just going to add billions and trillions of dollars on top of it. Why don't we address the fundamental flaws with our healthcare system and how we reimburse doctors and hospitals and try to get some cost containment herein?
President Obama also will make a healthcare speech today. The Army will need 22,000 new active duty soldiers. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the force needs to grow to handle new responsibilities around the world. Now, one of those new responsibilities is, of course, Afghanistan, and there's new deadly violence there today. Some 14 are dead after multiple suicide attacks in various cities. And all this comes as NATO's chief urges allies to stay committed to the mission in Afghanistan.
NATO must succeed. Withdrawing now would mean Afghanistan again to the Taliban. It would mean destabilization of the region. It would mean an export of terrorism. And it would mean that we would see in practice in European and US capitals as well that the security in Afghanistan is inextricably linked to our own security here in London or in Brussels or in Amsterdam.
And that's the NATO Chief Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, who spoke with our partner, the BBC, trying to put the conflict in Afghanistan in a more global context. Now, last Tuesday night, you may remember that the president appeared at the All-Star Game in St. Louis, and he threw out the first pitch. Now, he got lots of coverage, and a lot of that coverage was focused on his jeans. Now, some even said he was wearing mum's jeans. On NBC's Today Show, Meredith Vieira gave the president a chance to defend his style.
Michelle, she looks fabulous. I'm a little frumpy. You know, basically, up until a few years ago, I only had four suits. She used to tease me because they'd get really shiny. I hate to shop. Those jeans are comfortable. And for those of you who, you know, want your president to, you know, look great in his tight jeans, I'm sorry, I'm not the guy.
He won't be wearing any tight jeans. The president is a frump, and there ends your news.
Thanks, Femi.
Thank you, Femi. There is a new weapon to fight the war on drugs, and I am not talking about undercover cops tracking cocaine gangs. These drugs are life-saving pharmaceuticals, pills to fight malaria and other diseases in the developing world. But the World Health Organization has estimated that as many as one in four of these pharmaceuticals is fake, not what they are supposed to be, which means pill takers could die. The good news is there's a way to find them. Here to tell us more is Facundo Fernandez, Associate Chemistry Professor at Georgia Institute of Technology. Fernandez is part of an informal international team that is working together to track down fake drugs. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, the weapon, your magic weapon. How are you tracking down these fake drugs?
What we do with the CISPARTACIS informal team that you were mentioning is we try to look at the composition of these fakes. That ranges from looking at the chemicals inside of the tablets and also looking at any particles that could be trapped into the tablet, meaning particles of pollen or things like that.
And specifically, the actual instrument you're using is a mass spectrometer, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. It's mass spectrometer. It's a tool that's used commonly in chemistry, and it's been being perfected over the years, over and over. And now modern instruments are extremely sensitive.
And as I understand it, the big breakthrough came when you could look at more than one at a time. I mean, you don't have to literally hold up every single pill and analyze it in a batch. Is that right?
Well, the breakthrough that the community is achieving, including our group, is to be able to look at these tablets without dissolving them. So you can hold the tablet in front of the instrument, in front of the place where the ionization takes place, and you can get a quick view of what's in the tablet.
Tell me the worst that you have found. Let's take a malaria pill. What have you discovered in so-called actual malaria pills?
We have found a huge range of what we call wrong active ingredients, and probably the most shocking case was a recent case that we found. There was one of these combination anti-malarials, the most recent type of anti-malarials contained sildenafil, which is the active ingredient in Viagra.
What exactly can Viagra do to help a malaria patient?
Well, I'm not a medical expert, but as far as I know, pretty much nothing.
Nothing. Okay. What percentage of malaria pills are fake?
The estimates range from, in Southeast Asia, where we work, between 20% and, in some cases, up to 90%.
90%?
90%. So depending on how you look and what type of medicines you're looking at, but it's pretty bad.
Clearly, if you take the wrong medication, you are in danger of further illness or perhaps even dying from the original disease. But there's other implications, too, aren't there? If you take a pill that has active ingredients that are not what you're supposed to be taking, what can that do to you?
Well, the first risk is it could actually mask the symptoms of the disease. So, for example, if a symptom is fever in the case of malaria and you take a fake tablet that contains acetaminophen, that will lower your fever. So it will look like the disease is going away, but it's not. And the second main risk is that the wrong active ingredients could generate resistance in the parasites to the anti-malarial drugs. And that's actually a longer-term risk, and it's also very important.
We're talking to Facundo Fernandez, Associate Chemistry Professor at Georgia Institute of Technology, about the issue of fake drugs. Mr. Fernandez, is there a problem in this country about fake pharmaceuticals?
I think the problem is increasing, but it's not as bad as in developing countries. We are suffering from the pressure of importing pharmaceuticals and importing raw materials, and the FDA is under pressure to check all these materials. But we're lucky that we have a better system than in other countries.
So our FDA takes care of us?
Well, they do their best, and you know, I have no connections with them, really, but I think it's a huge task. So if you have to check all imports coming into the country, it's pretty difficult. So,
What can an average, what can a consumer do to protect him or herself against getting a fake drug?
I would say that the best tool is common sense. And common sense really means if something looks like too good of a deal to be true, don't do it. Because if the tablets are cheap, it's because they don't really contain the active ingredients. So
You're saying don't buy online from some of these outlet places?
At least I would say be very, very careful if you decide to buy online, because there's a recent study that shows that in about 60% of the cases you can get fake drugs if you buy online.
This is Farai Chidea. When I think about this story, I think about also a completely different angle I have to bring up of pharmaceuticals entering the water supply. Does this mean that it's even more confusing, the sort of environmental effects, not just the drugs that you take into your mouth, but what people, frankly, excrete?
Absolutely. And the problem that you're bringing up, it's another extremely important problem, how these pharmaceuticals are going into our drinking water and how much makes it through the processing of our drinking water. I think it will confound that effect for sure. And also thinking in developing countries, how these pharmaceuticals are disposed of. When, you know, manufacturing of pharmaceuticals is not controlled, then disposing of pharmaceuticals is not controlled either.
Facundo Fernandez, Associate Chemistry Professor at Georgia Institute of Technology, thank you so much for your time. And you can read more about the war on fake drugs in today's Science Times in the New York Times.
Lynn, there is another healthcare issue on the plate, of course. That's Washington, how to pay for healthcare reform, what is covered, what shouldn't be on the table. Tell us. We want to know, what is the deal breaker in your mind? Taxing the wealthy, covering abortion. Amanda emailed us and she said dialysis after age 80 should not be covered. Tell us what you think shouldn't be negotiable at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Todd Zwillick is covering the healthcare debate. You can find him on Twitter and on healthcare reform. Here's your takeaway.
Everybody likes a goal. Nobody wants to make the tough decisions needed to get there. And so the president keeps calling in group after group, the American Medical Association of Doctors, the hospitals, the nurses, trying to work out a deal. Now, every one of these compromises serves to weaken the bill to some degree by pulling it in one direction or another.
That's the New York Times' David Hersenhorn.
I'm Lynn Scher.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
The president's approval ratings for his health care plan have dropped below 50%, and critics, including Republican Party Chair Michael Steele, are having their say.
The Barack Obama experiment with America is a risk our country can't afford. It's too much, too fast, too soon.
Healthcare reform, time to revise, revamp, rethink. Today on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 21st. I'm Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scher. We are filling in today for John Hockenberry. Morning.
Good morning, Farai. Great to be with you.
Absolutely. Same at you. And on our show today, we've got texting and driving. Hopefully you are not doing it now. We're going to look at new research on the dangers of distracted drivers. And our partner, the New York Times, is going to tell us why our government actually tried to cover that research up. We'll also take a closer look at Al-Qaeda's drug running. It's part terror group, part dope dealer. First, we want to get a preview of today's round of healthcare warfare in Washington. The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick keeps tabs on the Beltway battle lines for us. And Todd, what are we watching today?
Well, the president is jumping up on that bully pulpit finally, Farai, and he's got meetings with Blue Dog Democrats. Those are conservative Democrats in the House. There are bipartisan meetings continuing in the Senate. Everyone says bipartisanship is dead on health care. Not quite. There's still meetings to go. And then he's got to prep for that primetime news conference. That's tomorrow night.
Well, Todd, we're going to get you back in a second. Thanks so much for this. We're also going to talk to a governor to see how these changes could affect states. And right now we have your headlines. We are going to have to wait some 6 more months for a report on detaining terror suspects that was ordered by President Obama. The policy report was due out today. Its delay leaves questions hanging about how the administration is going to accomplish its goal of closing Guantanamo Bay by 2010. The Army needs 22,000 new active duty soldiers. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the force needs to grow to handle a bigger mission in Afghanistan and other responsibilities around the world. Right now, the Army has just over 500,000 troops.
Thanks, Farai. California now has an apparent deal to close its massive budget gap. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and top state lawmakers have a plan to close the $26 billion shortfall. Billions in programs will be cut. They'll make up the rest of the deficit through borrowing and shifting money around. A vote on the proposed plan could come on Thursday. Our partner, the New York Times, reports that a government agency covered up research on the dangers of driving while using mobile phones. A former federal safety chief says transit officials told him to bury the 2003 findings because the data could anger Congress and threaten Transportation Department funding.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now in Thailand, part of a larger Asian trip. Top topics today include North Korea and Myanmar, also known as Burma. Later this week, Clinton attends a summit of regional leaders. Now, in the markets, Wall Street gained more than 1% yesterday. The Dow starts trading at 8,848, the S&P at 951. That's an 8-month high. The NASDAQ kicks off at 1909. And we're going to be talking about texting and driving. Fess up. Have you done it? Walking, biking, driving? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us a ring or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
The next 2 weeks could determine whether President Obama's health care hopes will live or die, and it sounds like the president knows it.
Let's fight our way through the politics of the moment. Let's pass reform by the end of this year. Let's commit ourselves to delivering our country a better future.
Now, many Republicans hope to delay action until the fall, figuring that public opposition will grow to Obama's vision. And the health care battle has gone to the states. Many of the nation's governors from both parties attending the summer convention of the National Governors Association this weekend say they don't want Congress to force states to pick up extra health care expenses. Joining me this morning with the current status of the bill is our very own Todd Zwillick. Also on the line is the new chairman of the National Governors Association, Jim Douglas, the Republican governor of Vermont. I want to welcome you both, but let me start with Todd. why, after sitting this out a little bit, has the president jumped in, and what can he do now?
Well, he's got that famous bully pulpit, Farai, and Congress has been writing this bill all along, and Congress is 535 independent actors in a lot of ways. It's time to focus, and the president's role now, after giving Congress the power to shape this bill, they might have reached the high watermark about as far as they can go without agreeing. So he's got to try to focus them, and more importantly, focus the public, try to get them behind him. Yes, it's expensive, but if we don't make this investment, it's going to be more expensive in the long term. That's his message.
Now, there's a meeting with the Blue Dog Democrats, more conservative members of the House of Representatives. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, the Blue Dogs have a long track record of protesting against deficit spending and really expensive programs, and this bill is a little bit of both. Now, the president is on their side. He says he won't sign any bill that increases the deficit, so they probably agree on that regard. But it is expensive, and don't forget, members of Congress, including those moderate to conservative Democrats, took some really, really tough votes on the stimulus, even on climate change. They don't think politically they can afford to vote for another $1 trillion bill that may raise taxes on some people, now the rich, but some people, and then have it hang out there, and the Senate might kill it. They've taken a really politically difficult vote. So that's their problem in the House. They've taken some really tough votes for the president already. Now he's coming back and saying, stick with me this one more time. And a lot of them are saying, we've reached our limit.
Health care has been a third rail in the past. Now, I want to listen to a bit of a question to Republican Party Chair Michael Steele and his response.
Does President Obama's health care plan represent socialism?
Yes. Next question.
Okay. How does the president counter the S word?
The S word, socialism. Well, he counters it this way. Look, a lot of the American public do support a broader government role in health care. If you ask them, should the federal government be more involved in financing health care? A lot of them say yes. In fact, it's well over 50%. It's probably a little bit north of 60%. So you can say S-word socialism, R-word rationing. Those are very politically strong words, and Michael Steele knows it. That's why he's using them. But the president has some poll numbers and a lot of arguments on his side. Look, the system we have right now, no one thinks it's working.
Okay, that's Todd Zwillick, our own at The Takeaway. And stay with us, Todd. I am going to bring in Vermont Governor Jim Douglas, Republican and an incoming chairman of the National Governors Association. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
What do you not like about this health care plan right now?
Well, governors of both parties support health care reform. In fact, it's an imperative because it's such a huge percentage now of the gross national product and of the budgets of all of the 50 states. And if we don't get health care costs under control, it's going to be an even bigger percentage and crowd out other public services. The problem that governors across the political spectrum have is that we can't sustain an unfunded mandate from Washington. If the Congress wants to reform health care, and we hope we can work with them to accomplish that, the cost can't be passed on to the states.
So you use the term unfunded mandates. You just came from an annual meeting of the National Governors Association in Biloxi, Mississippi. Overall, what did you find out from other governors? What's the temperature?
Well, I think governors want health care reform, but a key part of that has to be containing costs. There's been a lot of focus on whether it should be a public plan or a private plan, but to be perfectly honest, unless we get costs under control, we're going to be broke either way. So I think the focus has to be more on how we can contain cost, how we can deploy strategies like managing chronic disease, on wellness, on prevention, on keeping people healthy. That has to be the major focus of our reform efforts.
Hey, Governor, this is Todd Zwillick, and I want to ask, you know, I assume by unfunded mandate you're talking about Medicaid, correct?
That's right. There have been proposals, as you know, to expand it to a higher percentage of the poverty level.
Right, and to get more middle-income to lower-income people under the umbrella of health insurance who aren't covered now. And in the past, you know, every time – this is not the first time the states have had trouble with their Medicaid finances. Can't you extract a promise from the president and from the Congress that, just like they have so many times in the past, if need be, they'll show up for you with some more Medicaid money so that you're made whole?
Well, the problem, as you indicated earlier, is that many members of Congress, and I think a lot of Americans, are concerned about the huge multi-trillion-dollar debt that the federal government is going to incur. So we have to find a way to understand the need for fiscal responsibility at the federal level while not passing a cost onto the states. I understand there may be some expense incurred in this effort, but for the long run, we have to bring down the cost of care. We spend nearly twice as much per capita on health care in America as the average industrialized nation, and yet the outcomes are no better. In fact, life expectancy in America is about 1 year less than it is in the average industrialized nation around the world. So we have to deliver care in a better way. We have to change how we maintain the health of the American people.
Are you a little more do you have a little more faith in what the Senate is doing in those terms, Governor? Wellness programs trying to do some more on bending the cost curve than maybe the House has accomplished so far?
Well, I met with Senator Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee, last week, and I was pleased to hear him talk about that. First of all, he's approaching it on a bipartisan basis, which is not the case in all the committees in Washington, and he understands the need for reforming the delivery system, changing the way providers are compensated, for example, and focusing more, as you suggest, on prevention, on wellness, on chronic illness. There are a couple of states I heard from my colleagues this week that are highlighting obesity. And frankly, if we can reduce the rate of obesity in America, there's going to be less chronic disease. And that's where 75% of the cost of health care is. So we've got to really focus on where those costs are and on bringing them down.
Well, Governor, again, we are speaking with Vermont Governor Jim Douglas, incoming chair of the National Governors Association. Governor, when you think about your specific state situation, there's one of your neighbors in New England, Massachusetts, that actually is wrangling over removing legal immigrants from its roles of health care. Are you going to have to make some drastic cuts? How are you doing?
No, we're doing quite well. In fact, I think the model that we put in place, we call the Vermont Blueprint for Health, is a model that other states might consider. In fact, I had the director of healthcare reform from Vermont speak at the conference this past weekend. We have a pretty low rate of uninsured in Vermont. We have a blended program of public subsidies for individuals who make up to 300% of the poverty level. We have some subsidies for people to get insurance through their employers. But what we also have is a waiver from the federal government to deploy Medicaid dollars in a new and, I think, exciting way. Usually Medicaid is not a health care plan. I call it a sick care plan because it pays for service providers render. But we have permission from the federal government to use it for preventive care, for intervening with people to manage their chronic illness. And we've seen a reduction in the number of trips to the emergency room and the doctor's office among our Medicaid population. So what we need is more flexibility. We need to allow states to be the proverbial laboratories of democracy. And I think a lot of states can really do some exciting things.
All right. Very quick question for you, Todd. There's been talk of this deadline in Congress of getting something going before the August recess. Is that realistic?
Well, it might not be, but, you know, deadlines in Congress are important. Again, we talked about focus. They have a way of focusing people, and if people aren't focused, they, especially lawmakers, they can scatter to the four winds with their own agendas. But let's not get too caught up in this August 7th thing. It's true the president said he wanted it, and if he doesn't get it, it will be some measure of his ability to whip the Congress into shape. But the Senate especially, never operates this way. They never have in history. If they don't get it done by August 7th, there will be plenty of time in September. It could be politically a little more difficult because of the criticism that the president will get. But if August 7th doesn't happen, health reform is not dead. I wouldn't be too worried about it if I were the president. The Senate operates on its own schedule.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you. We've been speaking with The Takeaway's own Todd Zwillick from Washington, D.C., and also with Vermont Governor Jim Douglas, a Republican and the incoming chairman of the National Governors Association. Thank you both so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Anthony, and I unfortunately text while I drive. Basically, my wife just totally freaks out every time I do it, especially when I have my four-month-old in the back seat with me. I don't really like to do it, but I'm just such an information junkie, I can't help myself.
Oh, dear. That is one of our listeners at The Takeaway. Sound familiar? Texting and driving. Ever done it? Come on. Fess up. What is the worst thing you've ever done while you've tried to multitask on the phone, texting or otherwise? Oh, my goodness. Walked in the middle of the street without looking? Biked while on your cell? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Tell us what the worst thing is you've never done. Here's an example.
It's just as irresponsible to have, like, an iPod in and be looking down and answering your email when you're crossing the street in Manhattan, you know? And I ride my bike most of the place in Manhattan, and I find, like, I'll get an email and, like, start riding with no hands and be answering my email riding up Christie Street or something, and I'm like, I am one of the stupidest people in this city.
Yeah, like, you might wind up somewhere worse than Christie Street if you're doing that, buddy. Okay, how about some statistics? Drivers using phones are 4 times as likely to cause a crash as other drivers, and the likelihood that they will crash is equal to that of someone with a 0.08% blood alcohol level. That's a few drinks, at least. Still, most states have refused to ban texting while driving, and no state has banned driving while talking on a phone. Although some of us in the back seats of cabs tell our drivers that either they get off the phone or they drive and we'll get out of the cab. Anyway, today there is new reporting from our partner, the New York Times. They tell us that some of the reasons why this is going on, including some surprising reporting that the United States withheld the data that showed how risky distracted driving is. Joining us is Adam Bryant, New York Times deputy business editor, who's been editing this project. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Adam, this is a two-part story. The first part was that amazing piece you had on Sunday where the reporter Matt Richtel recounts a terrible story of a young man whose life was upended by texting. Just briefly, remind us what that was about.
Sure. He was a good kid with a clean driving record, stopped into a Goodwill store to check out a dresser for a neighbor, pulled out of the parking lot, was on his phone, and he broadsided a car that was coming from the other direction and killed the woman. She died just a few hours later, and he was basically distracted by his phone, and he's been distraught, and it's sort of a remarkable tale of how just anybody can do this. And I think, as some of your comments at the open of the show suggested, a lot of people do it.
Indeed. And I must say, before we move on, I think one of the most remarkable things about that story is part of his punishment is that he's got to go around and talk to young people about this, and they all are astonished that somebody actually hit somebody and killed somebody while doing it.
Yeah, and it really is. And again, your comments were great at the beginning of the show from the listeners. I really think it is something that everybody does at some point, and we all make that brief calculation in our head that, sure, maybe this is a little bit risky, but I'm pretty good at multitasking, and I really need to check my email, or I really need to take this call. And I think just collectively we're making all these small little decisions, but, across the country, I think it's pretty clear that adds up to a safety risk, especially when you look at the research. I mean, it's just, there's no doubt that it is dangerous.
Indeed. And let's listen to another listener who told us what she does on the while she's driving.
I'm Sasha. I'm in Los Angeles, and I do T9. Yeah, it makes it a lot easier. But at the same time, with T9, you know, sometimes, like, I know that the wrong word is going to come up first, so I do have to take a glance to make sure which word came up.
So even when you've got the auto fill-in thing where it fills in the words, you're still in trouble. Let's, Adam Bryant, deputy business editor of the New York Times. Let's move on with you. Why has legislation failed in so many states when we know what the risk is?
Well, I think part of it is a lack of data, and it becomes a little bit of catch-22 that a lot of people say, well, there's not enough data to prove that it's a risk, but no states are really making the effort to gather the data. When accidents occur, police rarely, who arrive on the accident scene, the forms they fill out, there's generally no box to check that electronic devices played any role. So it just becomes this sort of circle where, well, there's not enough data to prove it's dangerous, but we're not making the effort to gather the data.
And indeed, there was supposed to be a study to determine how widespread this was. What happened to that study and why?
Well, that was part of the recommendations that were made in 2003 by NHTSA. They put together about 250 pages of research and documentation showing the dangers, made a number of policy recommendations, but they were never acted on. And it appears from talking to the people involved in that decision that there were a couple of reasons. One, back to this idea that the data was inconclusive and that there wasn't enough to sort of clearly state, although some people object to that. The other point is that there was concern about the Appropriations Committee in Congress that if NHTSA was perceived as lobbying states, that might hurt NHTSA's funding from Congress. And NHTSA's mission is to kind of set the agenda for the traffic safety for the nation. But some people were concerned that this would be sort of tripping over the line into them lobbying states, which was seen as kind of not an appropriate role for NHTSA.
So excuse me for being a little naive here, but are you saying that the reason the study was done was they didn't want to see the results of the study because that could offend the people that had to act on the results of the study?
Well, I think some people are seeing our story that way. There's quite a few reader comments on our website that are raising that precise point.
What has been the response to your stories? I mean, we all heard the response to our putting out the call. And by the way, we do want to hear from more of you. Tell us the most terrible thing you've done multitasking with your mobile phone while driving. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Adam Bryant, Deputy Business Editor at The New York Times, what are you hearing from your readers?
Well, so far on our website, we've got about 700 reader comments, and some people are sort of astounded that Christopher Hill, the man who killed the woman because he was driving and talking on his cell phone, that it was only a misdemeanor, and people say the laws have to be toughened. Some people say, you know, we just need to ban this outright, like many countries do. But there is a sort of broader question here, I think, about what we perceive as an accident in this country. If we figure that everybody is supposed to be able to talk on their phone while driving and they kill somebody or get in a crash, then, oh, well, that's just an accident. But it does seem to be starting a broader conversation of whether, you know, we are putting other people at risk by doing this in the first place.
And the conversation will go on. We'll talk about this more with you sometime in the future. Adam Bryant, New York Times Deputy Business Editor, the full body of research on thetakeaway.org for a link to the documents.
And coming up, we're going to talk about Afghanistan and a new role in the war on drugs.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea in with Lynn Scher for John, who is away. And now we have Femi Okay with headlines.
Thank you. It's almost 28 minutes to the top of the hour. On Capitol Hill, Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor has one more Republican vote, that of Maine Senator Susan Collins. A full Senate vote is expected by the end of the summer. Meanwhile, a vote by the Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled for later today. Republicans are expected to force a 1-week delay. Now, you can always count on California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger for a good movie reference. If the California budget crisis had a soundtrack, this would probably be it. Fry, are you feeling the tension?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, so Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and top California lawmakers plan billions in program cuts to solve the state's $26 billion budget gap. Now, speaking after a marathon session yesterday, here's Governor Schwarzenegger.
We've accomplished a lot in this budget, and I want to thank the legislative leaders for hanging in there and negotiating all these weeks and especially the last few hours. It was like a suspense movie.
The suspense was killing us, but a full vote on the proposal is expected on Thursday. The plan comes nearly 3 weeks after the state began issuing IOUs to state contractors and vendors. I think we should have soundtrack for every news story.
Absolutely. I mean, anyway, it's just too much, too much. Thank you so much, Femi.
You're very welcome.
I want to move to a topic which is occurring in a very critical region of the world right now. I'm talking about Afghanistan, and the U.S. government is deploying dozens of Drug Enforcement Administration agents there. It's a new kind of surge, fighting drug networks that officials say are funding the Taliban, corrupting the Afghan government. Biggest expansion of the agency's role in DEA history. Now, does this show that the U.S. thinks that we can't win the war in Afghanistan with troops alone? With us today, we have Gretchen Peters, former Afghanistan and Pakistan correspondent for ABC and author of Seeds of Terror, How Heroin is Bankrolling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Now, Gretchen, paint us a picture of what happens from the villages where people grow poppies into the Taliban's pocket. How does that translate into funds for the Taliban?
Well, the Taliban earn from the opium trade in various different ways. They do tax the farmers in some areas. They actually cart off about 10% of the farmers' crops on average. In other, but their big earnings come from protecting drug shipments as they leave the farm area, protecting the drug convoys as they head towards the borders, and also taxing and in some cases running drug refineries. They also receive money from the big trafficking cartels. The Taliban are not actually running the drug business, but they are facilitating it and protecting it and taxing it. So the new DEA plan aims to try and go after the cartels that are, you know, run by businessmen who have been operating along the border for decades. And these cartels are not just working with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups. They're also working with corrupt officials within the government. So the feeling is that they really need to go after these organizations, business organizations, and disrupt them, arrest the leaders of the cartels who have basically been able to function with impunity over several decades.
What kinds of interactions on this issue have there been between the U.S. representatives, whether they're troops or diplomats, and the government in Afghanistan? Is the government putting any local forces on the case?
Well, there have been... some big success stories in the fight against these cartels. Just 2 weeks ago, the DEA extradited a major smuggler named Haji Bajko to the United States. He was a smuggler in eastern Afghanistan. They found evidence in his records that more than $169 million had moved through this individual's hands in the last 10 months before they overran his hideout. There was another major smuggler, the man that I call the Pablo Escobar of Afghanistan, named Haji Juma Khan. He's currently currently incarcerated in New York. He was extradited last year in October. His organization moved more than $1 billion worth of drugs every year. So there have been success stories, but normally they have been individual smugglers, individual traffickers who have been brought to the United States to face trial. But in many cases, the trafficking groups that they run have not been disrupted. In other words, they'll grab the kingpin, but they don't actually disrupt the whole organization. So now there seems to be more of an organizational attack strategy being put into place. There have been there are American officials who work on this on a daily basis in Afghanistan with Afghan officials, and there have been setbacks as well. For instance, very recently, President Hamid Karzai pardoned five people who had been convicted of drug trafficking because some of them, at least, were connected to relatives of his reelection campaign. So setbacks and successes, it's going to be a long slog, I think.
Gretchen Peters, this is Lynn Scherr. To what extent is any of this heroin being used in Afghanistan itself, or is it all for export? Is this just for the world population, or are they using some of it as well?
Well, Lynn, that's a very good question. In fact, heroin use and opium use in Afghanistan is skyrocketing, particularly in the southern areas where the poppy crop is grown, because insecurity is so bad that all of the aid groups and health clinics and doctors have pulled out, and therefore people don't have access to medicine. And increasingly there are stories, and I have seen horrible, just shocking video of parents exhaling opium smoke into the mouths of their infants because they don't have any other medicine to give them.
So it's morphine. They're using it as morphine, basically.
They're using it as medicine. I mean, the opium poppy can be processed into any number of drugs. Generally in Afghanistan, it's processed into morphine base.
Well, let me just jump in here, Gretchen.
Sure.
We have to wrap up in just a minute, but Defense Secretary Gates announced that he's going to increase the U.S. Army by 22,000 troops, some going to Afghanistan. Are troops trained to deal with this? Will they help?
Well, I think that's one of the main challenges that the military faces, is that increasingly what the problem we face in Afghanistan and along the border with Pakistan is an issue of law enforcement.
Right.
Our soldiers are trained to fight a traditional military enemy, whether it's the Iraqi army or the Soviet army. And really what we're facing in Afghanistan are organizations, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, the other extremist groups, that really behave a lot more like criminal gangs.
Well, Gretchen Peters, former Afghanistan and Pakistan correspondent for ABC and author of Seeds of Terror, How Heroin is Bankrolling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Thank you. Lynn.
And by the way, Farai, we are getting great responses from all of you out there on multitasking when you're on the phone and the danger it causes.
I'm a professional truck driver, and texting is the scariest thing I see. Just trying to make a living and stay alive when there's people texting all over me, and it's worse than drunk, worse than grandma and grandpa in a motorhome.
Right on. You can share your story by phoning us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And then coming up, are labor unions on the brink, and how much power do they have today? That's in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Lynn Scherr. It has been a six-day moon fest as we've been celebrating the first moon landing 40 years ago. But it turns out that getting there was not the hardest part. The real puzzler, how to get off the moon to return to Earth. Joining us today to tell us what it was like for Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong when they departed from the moon 40 years ago today is Dan Derda. Dan is a planetary scientist at Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. He was also a finalist for the 2004 astronaut selection process, which means, Dan, you want to be an astronaut, right?
Good morning, Lynn. yes, that's been a focus of my adult professional life for quite a while.
Well, me too. I was a semifinalist in the Journalist in Space competition, and I would have gone in a second. But, of course, that competition ended shortly after the Challenger explosion. So better luck to you than me in any event. Getting off the moon, it seems counterintuitive. It seems as if it would be easier to get off the moon than to get to the moon. What was the big challenge?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, getting, of course, with the celebrations this week, we've been focused about, the launch on July 16th, leaving the Earth and that huge Saturn V, and, of course, the landing on the moon a few days later on the 20th yesterday. We tend to forget that the astronauts had to get going fast again off the surface of the moon in order to get back home, and anything involving getting going that fast that in that much of a hurry involves a lot of energy.
And you're going from a very different atmosphere from what we have here on Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. Leaving the Earth, you're traveling through this dense atmosphere. On the moon, you've got to remember, it's a vacuum on the surface of that moon. And so, one effect is you don't have to have an aerodynamic vehicle to lift off. And so the lunar lander itself was designed to operate completely in a vacuum, so it didn't have this sleek aerodynamic shape. It also wasn't an incredibly strong vehicle. It was it was wrapped in Mylar and had thin aluminum sheeting in places, and so the vehicle itself wasn't all that substantial.
What was the danger in taking off from the moon?
Well, unlike here on the Earth, where if something doesn't really quite work out right during the countdown and you're not quite comfortable with the situation, you can just sort of take a time out, take a breather, have your teams check everything, make sure everything's all right. On the moon, this was a one-time shot that the construction of the rocket engine, the motor that was used in that base of that lunar module to take off again, was designed to be a one-shot, one-turn-on operation. There was no way to actually test this engine after it was built before it was used. So it was, you're on the moon, you're off there a 250,000 miles from home, and you're testing this engine for the first time, and it better work that first time.
Unlike the International Space Station, for example, there was no second Apollo that was about to go up immediately that could have rescued anybody.
Yeah, that's right. There was no chance for Neil and Buzz on that surface. If something went wrong there, there's no way that Mike Collins, for instance, the closest human being to them orbiting around the moon in the command module, that command module was not designed to land on the surface. It didn't have enough fuel to get down to near the surface even to sort of pick them up in some way. If perhaps they had like limped into some barely feasible little orbit, it's possible that Mike could have come down and done something, but there was a good chance that he might have been coming home alone.
Well, it was a remarkable achievement all the way around, from liftoff to touchdown to coming back again. Just quickly, you have 5 seconds to answer. Are we going to Mars?
I certainly hope so. We will be someday. I don't know when it'll be, but hopefully someday very soon.
Okay. Dan Dirt, a planetary scientist at Southwest Research Institute, Department of Space Studies in Boulder, Colorado. And if you want to see video of the lunar liftoff on our website, takeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scherr, and we are in for John Hockenberry. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the future and influence of unions. That's in just a few minutes, right after headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. The New York Times Company has a deal with the Boston Globe's largest union to save the struggling paper some $10 million. Globe union members voted yesterday to cut their salaries nearly 6%. And this comes after a drawn-out fight between the Globe and the union, where at one point the Times Company threatened to close the Globe. The New York Times is one of the partners of The Takeaway. Today, President Obama sharpens his push for healthcare changes. He's meeting with conservative-leaning Democrats, trying to win more support for his agenda. The talk isn't all inside the Beltway. Vermont Republican Governor Jim Douglas doesn't want states to get stuck with the bill.
There's been a lot of focus on whether it should be a public plan or a private plan, but to be perfectly honest, unless we get costs under control, we're going to be broke either way.
So Governor Douglas spoke on The Takeaway earlier this hour. A report President Obama ordered on detaining terror suspects is now delayed by 6 months. The policy report was due out today. Its delay leaves questions hanging about how the administration will accomplish its goal of closing Guantanamo Bay on time. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke testifies on the Hill later this morning. Lawmakers will grill him as investors listen to his take on recent positive economic reports. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now in Thailand. This is part of a larger Asia trip that included an extended visit to India. Top topics even today include North Korea and Myanmar, also known as Burma. And finally, the White House goes country tonight. Oh yes, I know you're tapping your feet right now. The White House is hosting country music artists and students from around the country. It's part of a series highlighting arts education. Invited performers include Charlie Pride. Have a listen to him here. My favorite Charlie Pride song.
Texas.
takes me back to the days when I was working in radio on a country show. So also at the White House, Brad Paisley, Alison Krauss, and Union Station. And of course, you may remember earlier that the White House had a jazz night as well. So country tonight at the White House.
Thanks, Femi.
You're
I know that
welcome.
They also had the poetry jam, so I think klezmer has got to be next, followed by waltz night. I don't know.
Hip-hop,
yeah, absolutely.
I'd like to see that one.
All right, well, thanks again. And we're going to move on to the topic of labor unions. And are they on the brink? Labor leaders have pinned their hopes on a new bill in Congress called the Employee Free Choice Act. They hoped that something called a card check would be part of that bill. It makes it easier for employees to unionize. We have a couple folks with us to discuss the issue. Anya Kamenetz, friend of The Takeaway and writer for Fast Company magazine, plus Andy Stern, the president of the Service Employees International Union, one of the largest unions in North America. Now, Andy, I want to jump in. There's a card check option. What's a card check?
Well, there's a bill that allows some leveling of the playing field here. And what it basically says is just like when you vote for your board of directors in a company, you know, when a majority of people cast a ballot, sign a card, a proxy statement, it allows you to have an organization. Just begin to bargain with your employer, you know, about your wages and benefits in your future.
Your union has 2 million members in North America. It looks like this card check option may be eliminated from the legislation. If you can't help swing this, what's going to happen to your union and others?
Well, first of all, you know, I would say this is just part of the legislative process for anyone who's been watching a health care bill. I wish we all could predict, you know, how it was going to come out. And I think, you know, the bill's going to have amendments. There's going to be a version introduced in the House. So I think, you know, there's a long way to go. But here's the problem. American workers are facing the worst economic crisis in history. American workers, as you said in the recent headlines, are sharing in the pain. And the real question is, when the economy turns around, are we going to share in the gain? I mean, Goldman Sachs just, you know, reported $3 billion of profits. They own companies like Aramark, you know, food service workers, low-paid workers. And when those workers want to have an organization, have a union, you know, what do? They hire high-priced lawyers, they interrogate and they fire people. They even hold dues from the union even when they win the election. So we have to decide, do we want a Goldman Sachs economy or do we want an economy that works for everyone? The Employee Free Choice Act lets workers make that choice.
All right. I want to turn to Anya. You are a writer for Fast Company magazine. You've been tracking these issues. Just give us a sense of the state of unions.
Well, so the state of unions today is in some areas weaker than it's ever been, right? The percentage of unionization in the U.S. workforce peaked back in 1954 at 28%, and now it's at 12%. So it's a really precipitous drop. You know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported just a couple weeks ago that we'd gone 7 months without any major labor action, and that was the longest period that we've gone without any labor action involving more than 1,000 workers since 1981. So even at this time when workers are feeling this desperation, they're feeling really without options. I mean, you heard at the top of the hour or just now, you know, the Boston Globe, well, unions being forced to give up concessions in a time of economic desperation. So, you know, I guess the question is, are unions really positioned to be the ones strengthening workers?
What about the political ramifications of unions? Because it's not just about the numbers, is it? There's also the effect of government liaisons.
Well, I think that the heroic work of organizers like Andy Stern, who has really become a leader in, you know, the progressive movement in general, not just for workers, but, you know, what labor unions have always done really well is organized. And, you know, they're able to turn people out for elections, they're able to turn people out for rallies and for political actions. And that has led to them maybe occupying an outsized position in the political landscape as opposed to their actual position for, you know, most Americans.
Let me turn to Andy Stern. This is Lynn Scherr. In view of what Anya just said, Andy, are labor unions becoming obsolete? Is there a danger of that?
Well, I think there's a danger if we don't do something about this law that, you know, we see in political elections, unions have a certain amount of influence because the elections are fair. You know, we don't ask people at work, are you a Democrat or Republican? We don't, you know, follow them around when they leave work. We don't interrogate them. We let people exercise their free choice. And I think the question for American labor unions is we have laws now where 34% of employers fire people when they want to have a union. 73% hire these high-priced consultants. People wait 7 years for justice. You know, we couldn't win an American democracy, political elections, if we had those kind of rules. And I think what we're trying to do right now is just level the playing field, make it fair. And I think you will see, as you saw in the 30s with Roosevelt, when they changed the rules, not just unions come back, but the middle class come back, because that's really the question here. Or is we going to have the Goldman Sachs Walmart economy, or is everyone going to share not just in the pain, but in the gains?
Andy Stern, president of the State Employee International Union. Farai?
Yes. Andy, your union is so big, and you're not just in the U.S. You are in other parts of North America. When I think about what is going on in this economy today, you're talking about companies, big companies doing well, workers not doing well. But don't unions like yours actually bear some of the responsibility for making choices, for example, to protect higher wage union jobs and not expand your base?
Well, I can only speak to our union. We've spent the last several years doing, the largest campaign for African-American workers in the history of the labor movement, which is organizing security guards from coast to coast. We've been organizing women who take care of children in their home, family child care providers. We've been organizing home care workers. We've actually brought some dignity, some respect, and some ways for people, have these in jobs that are invisible, and janitors as well, to begin to find a way into the middle class. So I think unions are trying to make the changes that are necessary. We're working with community organizations on trying to make these green jobs, good jobs. I think the question is, are we going to have a country where people get to make, a free choice, or are we going to have a political system that allows employers, to run rampant in Washington and run rampant when it comes to union elections?
All right. Anya Kamenetz from Fast Company, you get the last word. Are we expecting that this bill in some form, maybe without card check, is a done deal and will be approved?
I hope that it's going to be approved. I think it's going to be approved. I think that, the consensus is changing somewhat. Whether or not unions can do it alone and bring back the middle class all by themselves, I don't know.
I want to thank both of you, Anya Kamenetz, writer for Fast Company magazine, author of the book Generation Debt, plus Andy Stern, president of SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. We are always on at The Takeaway. You can just visit us at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, have your say on the dangers of being distracted while texting and driving.
I'm guilty of texting while driving. I think there should be an addendum to the driver's ed classes that simulate the perils of texting while driving.
My name is Rusty. I'm from Detroit, Michigan, and I think that actually calling The Takeaway is quite possibly the riskiest thing I have done on electronic device while in the car. Thought it was kind of humorous that the very show I listen to may eventually be my very bane of existence.
Wow. Ooh, fatalistic. Come on, man. Stay with us. Stay with us. Stay with us. Just put down the phone and give us your take at our website, thetakeaway.org.
No texting while driving. I'm Lynn Scherer.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.